An off-year election day put the spotlight on Virginia, Kentucky, and Mississippi.
It had the feel of a good shot for Democrats, but it just didn't play out that way here in Mississippi. This is still a ruby red state.
We'll see what these races might tell us about the national mood ahead of 2020. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway for November 6th. Also on the podcast, young people online are blaming baby boomers for the country's problems.
It seems like what they've taught me is a very outdated version of my own beliefs now. And don't even get me started on my grandparents who were born in the 30s and 40s.
Will a new internet catchphrase help smooth the generational divide? Well,
okay, boomer.
Let's start there.
Because we get around.
Okay, boomer. Those two words have become the latest catchphrase for a younger generation expressing its frustration with their older counterparts. And if you're tired of talking about millennials, well, this latest battle in the so-called generation wars is between Generation Z, those born roughly between the mid to late 90s and 2010, and baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964. And it was born on the social media platform TikTok. In one of the site's short videos, an unidentified older man wearing a baseball cap and a polo shirt rails against younger people, saying,
"The millennials in Generation Z have the Peter Pan syndrome. They don't ever want to grow up."
And now there are thousands of similar videos on TikTok subverting this man's rant.
Boomers don't understand anything. They don't understand today's culture. They don't understand technology. They don't understand my sense of humor. And they definitely don't understand my taste in music. So I got exactly two words for you.
Okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer.
Plus hashtags, merchandise, and even a song.
Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer. Okay, boomer.
But these generational barbs gloss over many of the nuances that define each generation. And I'm now joined by Philip Bump, national correspondent for The Washington Post, and Ernest Owens, writer-at-large for Philadelphia Magazine. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Of course.
Thank you.
Ernest, we're going to start with you. For those of us who are not fluent in TikTok, walk us through, what is this latest rallying cry for Gen Z and millennials? We spoke to a boomer yesterday who said, "I didn't even know I was the target of all this."
Well, first of all, that's a very boomer thing to say, target. I think that pretty much this is just a response to a lot of the ongoing critiques that a lot of young people, millennials like myself and younger people like Gen Zers have experienced over the years, where we've seen so many articles, especially millennials, saying things like, you know, millennials are killing mayonnaise, they're killing the culture, they're ruining the, you know, the housing market. It's 1,000 articles out there that is consistently criticizing young people for a lot of things that arguably, you know, previous generations before us played a bigger role in. And so I think this is just that collective cultural, you know, response to years of being piled on critiques about our generation. And so, you know, to those who are hearing this or feeling attacked, it's like, well, did you ever think about us when all of these different headlines came out blaming millennials for this and Gen Zers for that? You know, I just think it's hilarious.
Well, Philip, as a Gen Xer myself, mm-hmm. I am supposed to be the neutral arbiter right. in all of this, the middle child, if you will. So is it fair to say that the OK Boomer phenomenon, to Ernest's point, isn't really rooted in this generational warfare, but actual criticism about things like global warming and who has the power in this world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly part of it. I will also stipulate at the outset that I, too, am Gen X. So
thank God.
God bless.
Yes.
I think there certainly is. There are a lot of, I think, factors here. One is just the fact that older people always complain about younger people, right? I mean, like this narrative of get off my lawn, that's something that very much predates the current moment. This is, you know, that's what old people do, you know, stereotypically, is they complain about what young people are doing. So there's certainly an aspect of that here. But it certainly is also the case that there were actual real changes between the world in which the boomers grew up and the world in which the millennials grew up. And those changes are, to some extent, you know, the boomers came out of World War II and they had good jobs and that paid well, and they were members of unions, and they also drove cars, and they lived in the suburbs, and they contributed a lot to climate change, and they, you know, pumped a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Those are the sorts of things now that millennials look at and say, A, I wish I had that, and B, I wish you hadn't done that. And so there certainly is a reason why they may be frustrated with that. At the same time, the millennials are also growing up in an era when they have access to the internet, they have access to TikTok, and their voices can be amplified in a way that wasn't the case when boomers were younger, when you and I were younger as Gen Xers. There simply is a better, there is a more of an ability for this group of people to be heard. And so they're making those voices heard very clearly.
Yes, I remember dial-up, but we did not have social media. So we were there at the beginning of the internet.
That's right.
Ernest, one of the things that I was talking about or tweeting about last week was sort of who we're talking about when we talk about boomers. How does race, ethnicity, immigration status fall into this? Because I asked people last week on Twitter, I was like, well, I don't know. Like, if your parents were Black, brown, Asian immigrants, would you actually be able to say, okay, boomer? And some people feared for their lives, metaphorically at least.
Well, you know, I think that the language is changed. So, you know, in a lot of, you know, Black culture, we don't use the word boomer as much, but we'll say things like old head. Okay. And so that is typically the same type of, I guess, vibe that could be expressed. I live in Philadelphia currently, and people say young bull or young buck to describe younger people. And so there is always this type of, you know, cultural generational clash, but the sentiment is the same. We're just communicating it through different, you know, vernacular and different types of slang and different types of language. So I think boomers are very, it's a manufactured, you know, word by a lot of, you know, white people who've kind of pushed that through pop culture. But different cultures have different names, and the sentiment is, again, the same. And I think a lot of this is being pushed, you know, by capitalism, arguably. These terms are designated ways to, you know, really carve out communities that one could, you know, market to or tailor things to. And so I think, you know, in many ways, in different communities, the language changes, but the sentiment remains the same.
Philip, we got about 30 seconds in this segment.
Sure.
Is Gen Z and millennials really talking about the most privileged members of the boomer generation when they're throwing these barbs?
Sure, yeah. I mean, obviously, when you use stereotypes, you tend to be referring to not the entire set of people. You know, I think the demographic point that you raised, though, is a very important one. I looked at this last week. You know, 3/4 of people 65 and older are white. Half of people who are younger than 18 are non-white, right? And so there also are other overlapping demographic trends here that are important.
Ernest, let's get back to you, because there was somebody who waded into this conversation about a week ago, someone we all know, former President Barack Obama, who made comments about so-called cancel culture. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
This idea of purity and you're never compromised and you're always politically woke and all that stuff, you should get over that quickly. The world is messy. There are ambiguities.
So, Ernest, the president, former president, they're saying woke. What did you think about this whole cancel culture comment from former President Barack Obama?
I'll say this by prefacing that I do think that President Barack Obama has probably been one of the best presidents we've had in a long, long time. And that we agree on a lot of things, but there is just something about the way that Obama sometimes tries to find common ground that he oversimplifies something that is bigger. And in this regard, I think the way in which he treats this conversation around, you know, cancel culture to be very paternalistic in a way that really reduces the real conversations and the real activism and the real power of social media. The same type of push and of use of social media that really got him elected. It took a lot of young, woke people that really drove social media to get him elected, but also further conversations like Black Lives Matter, like the Me Too movement, like, you know, Are You Okay, Sis? And a lot of young people working alongside a lot of, you know, Gen Xers and others to help you know, keep pushing these conversations and doing so in ways that made sense for them. You know, social media to me is not a deterrent, but a tool. It's not the end all be all, but it shouldn't be something that we should keep ignoring in these conversations. And it seems like the former president really, you know, kind of predates himself in really trying to push respectability politics when it comes to how people exchange their views. It's a new day.
Philip, and we have not, I mean, this isn't new. We, you know, we said, you said earlier, you know, the get off my lawn thing right. for older generations. We also look at boomers themselves, right, and say they were going against their own parents right, in many right. ways, right, with a lot of the social change that we see today. So, I mean, why have boomers been singled out as this sort of discrete generation that just doesn't get it?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, this the idea of teens being a counterculture is not new. I mean, this is James Dean's whole shtick, right? You know, but it certainly was the boomer generation that really established themselves as a political voice as being countercultural. And the reason why is because there's a lot of them, right? I mean, the only real demographic group we're talking about here is the baby boomers. So I talked to the Census Bureau in 2014. They made very clear the boomers are the only ones that actually met a demographic description of being a generation, right? All the rest are marketing terms, as was said earlier.
Wait, you're giving me an existential crisis here, Phil.
Sure. Oh,
like,
no,
are we
absolutely.
Not a generation?
Well, I mean, like, I'm sure you talk to people who are like, oh, I was born in 1980. What am I? And
oh
the answer
God,
is,
yes.
You're nothing. Like, it's all made up. Don't worry about it, right? So anyway, the point being that since there were so many boomers, they had their voices heard in a way that they weren't expecting. Now, what's fascinating about the millennials is there's a lot of millennials too, right? And so when I talked to the Census Bureau, they said, well, they're keeping an eye on it. This was several years ago, so it may have changed by now. But the millennials may themselves be, because of the number of them, a distinct generational, like something that can be identified as a generation. There's a lot of millennials. There's a lot of boomers. And the fascinating thing that's going to happen is, as we watch what happens in the United States is getting less white and it is getting grayer, right? By 2050, there's going to be an increase in the percentage of Americans who are over the age of 65. There are going to be older people who hold on to power for a long time in a way that we're not used to seeing because there's a lot of boomers and people are living longer, right? And so this is going – this I think we're at the front end of a wave of a lot of millennials who are coming up. There are a lot of them, unfortunately more than us Gen Xers, you know, even though we are, of course, the best generation.
Yes,
but
no
all
no
those
cares,
millennials
that's fine.
Are going to be coming up behind them and seeing these boomers who are still in positions of power for a long time. And that's going to add to the political tension that we're just starting to see emerge.
Ernest, what do you think about that? I mean, you've described yourself as a millennial. And I think one of the things that millennials and Gen Zers have been accused of largely is sort of cancel culture. Right. Is that one of the defining elements of millennials and Gen Z right now?
Cancel culture has been out before it was cancel culture. It was boycotts. It was protests. Cancel culture isn't anything new. It's something that we've learned. And one interesting conversations that really surprised me about this, that for all the harsh critiques about millennials, I have to ask the question, where, you know, did we get this from? How did we get these tools? How did we get here? There was a lineage. And it just seems like, you know, everyone forgets that, you know, boomers are our grandparents. Some of them are our parents. You know, Gen Xers are our parents in certain cases. So it's kind of weird that, you know, you would think that we were a band.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
An island of people that were just by ourselves that just kind of, you know, did whatever. And I don't think that cancel culture, I think the term is a millennial term, just like, okay, boomer is a new term, right, from Gen Zers and us. But it's the same rhetoric. It's the same conversations, but we're just rephrasing them and remarketing them and we're finding ways to capitalize off of the tension, right? There's a growing wave of nostalgia, and people are looking for certain types of age, class, and groups to distinguish people so they can be able to sell to them, so they can be able to make them feel a sense of unity or purpose or a collective community, because that's what we do in America. We really love to make a lot of distinctions, even when they don't make sense. And In this case, that's what's happening here.
Philip, your response.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, I think one of the fascinating things that, particularly when you raise Barack Obama, who's been sort of been on this kick for a while, there's a great conversation between Ta-Nehisi Coates and Jonathan Chait about 5 years ago, looking at Obama saying similar things back then. But what's changed? Last time Barack Obama ran for office was 2012. In 2014, we really saw the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. We saw in 2017 the emergence of Me Too. And Black Lives Matter in particular really reshaped how a lot of Americans think about race in politics in particular. And so that actually came after Barack Obama was a politician. I mean, it happened while he was in office, but not while he was running for office. And I think that also is informing a lot of this cancel culture stuff, which is really rooted in respecting other people's identities, which is something that came to a lot of prominence with the emergence of Black Lives Matter over the course of the past 5 years.
And I wonder if some of this is also, we've got like literally 10 seconds left, but I'm wondering, Ernest, yes or no, is some of this taking the focus off the bigger issues? I mean, I don't think anybody's 401k is in good shape right now, regardless of what generation you're in.
Absolutely. People need to just really look at the things that bring us together and what are some of the major points that we're all experiencing. I think everyone knows the economy is a mess. The environment needs work and support. And if millennials are going to counsel people who are not supporting that, we should be supporting them.
And there we go. Ernest Owens, freelance journalist, and Philip Bump, national correspondent at The Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Jose from North Hollywood. My dad is Generation X. He just turned 50 this year. He's been with the same company for 30 years. He's done well for himself, being an immigrant with no high school diploma. He got his job when he was 20. I'm 30 years old myself. And we've gone back and forth in regards to why I haven't settled and found a good career. He believes me and my generation tend to be lazy.
My parents and I have had a difficult time talking about climate change and the future of the Earth. Politically, we're aligned, but as my kids are still young, I have found it hard sometimes to engage in conversations where the other person feels there is no hope.
Hi, I'm Jesse Dawson from Greensburg, Kentucky, and I do find it hard to talk to people about issues going on in today's world, especially if they're younger than I am and they don't have the life experiences that I do.
Hi, my name is Farida, and I am from Massachusetts. I do find it hard to talk to anyone about politics. Policy is how I try to approach a conversation, but there's so much disinformation out there in the age, information age, that is so readily available, but it's hard to find the truth.
Hi, my name is Mary from Philadelphia. I find it easier to speak to people who are not of my generation, mostly younger people, because I'm 75. I find them to be more forward-looking, on the whole, more socially responsible, and also more open-minded than people of my generation. They're a pleasure to talk to.
Hey, this is Annette in Harlem, New York. I think the reason why I get to talk more open with people that are younger, millennials, or older people, because it just seems that both of those are more educated and they have less hang-ups. One, because they're young and things are different, and the other one, because they've already lived. So in my generation, I just find that most of the people are just too stubborn.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Tuesday was election day in a number of southern states that could serve as bellwethers ahead of 2020. In Virginia, Democrats pulled off significant victories, flipping control of the state House and Senate. And Kentucky was another bright spot for Democrats, as Andy Beshear won a tight vote against opponent incumbent Republican Matt Bevin, who has not yet conceded in the race. And while the state typically leans right in presidential elections, Bevin's was not particularly well-liked in his state, holding an approval rating of just 34%, according to a Morning Consult poll from October. For more, I'm joined now by Daniel Durocher, political reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Bevin is not conceding. What is that all about?
Yeah, so last night when 100% of the precincts were in, Andy Beshear was winning by around 5,000 votes. And so it's not exactly unusual for someone to not concede when the race is that close. He'll have 7 days to request a re-canvass, which is where they just kind of go around and make sure that all the county clerks got their vote totals right. And then after that, that's when things would start to get more involved if he wanted to keep pushing it down the line. And that's where things would start to get more unusual if he wanted to keep pushing it down the line and continue to challenge the results.
Tell us a little bit about the issues that dominated the race and what looks like could have tipped the scales in favor of Beshear right now.
Really, I think the best way to put it is that this race was about Matt Bevin, right? He is a guy who was kind of historically unpopular, despite his conservative stances in Kentucky. And a lot of that comes from the way that he speaks, the way that, you know, his personality is. And some examples of that is when the teachers protested in Frankfurt, Bevin guaranteed that a child was sexually assaulted because teachers were protesting it in Frankfurt and children may have been left home alone. He went after judges. He went after members of his own party. You know, he would criticize the Republican Senate president for not understanding legislation. He would go after reporters. He would go after basically anyone who tried to question him. And, you know, Bevin painted this as him being the guy who will tell you the truth and fix Kentucky and set it on the right track. But it really rubbed a lot of Kentuckians the wrong way.
There was another interesting race that happened in the state of Kentucky. Daniel Cameron won the race to be Kentucky's next attorney general. He will be the state's first African-American attorney general and the first Republican to hold the office in about 70 years. Tell us about Cameron and what his appeal was to Kentucky voters.
So Daniel Cameron is this kind of protege of U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And so he got a ton of support from the Mitch McConnell machine in Kentucky. And that was really, you know, what kind of put him over the edge. He's a relatively young lawyer. He had clerked for a judge. He had been Senator McConnell's counsel. And the Democrat tried to kind of use that against him and say that he's not experienced enough to be attorney general. But that really didn't work. And I think that, you know, what that indication about Daniel Cameron is that, you know, Kentucky's still largely a red state. You know, Matt Bevin's race was the outlier in this campaign, but Daniel Cameron, along with the rest of the Republicans on the ticket, they all won their races.
Now, to that point, Daniel, of course, we have to talk about where or whether this election will indicate anything about where Kentucky might be headed in 2020.
I personally think that it's really hard to draw conclusions from this race just because Matt Bevin is such a, you know, he is his own thing. You know, when I was out on the campaign trail, I would talk to a lot of people and they would love President Trump, but they would hate Matt Bevin. And so, you know, President Trump did come in and, you know, some people felt like President Trump's association with Bevin helped Bevin. And so you're looking at this situation where, you know, yes, Trump could not help Bevin cross the finish line, but Bevin's association with Trump certainly helped him.
Daniel DeRocher is a political reporter for the Lexington Herald Leader. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And now we go to Mississippi, where Republican Tate Reeves defeated Democrat Attorney General Jim Hood in last night's governor's election. And although Hood was running as a Democrat in a staunchly red state, he still appealed to moderates and independents through his pro-life and pro-gun stances. But in Mississippi, that was still not enough. For more on Mississippi's election, I'm joined by Adam Ganishow, political reporter with Mississippi Today. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
So how did Tate Reeves pull off the win?
I think it's as easy as looking at Northeast Mississippi. Attorney General Jim Hood has won 4 statewide elections previously, going back to 2003. He's done so in his home region, Northeast Mississippi. A lot of white moderate conservatives live in that region of the state. Last night, Tate Reeves just absolutely swept that region of the state. A lot of prognosticators have sort of initially suspected that the reason the Republican Tate Reeves did so well in that region is because President Donald Trump came to visit that very region on Friday, so just 5 days ago. And, you know, if the Democrat couldn't win that region, I think everyone assumed that was the battleground. The Democrat couldn't win there, it probably wasn't going to happen. And I think that's what we saw play out yesterday.
And as we mentioned at the top, this wasn't just any Democrat. This was a Democrat who was pro-life and pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun. And that still didn't sway enough voters.
That's right. Yeah. Jim Hood is a gun-toting, as he calls himself, gun-toting, Bible-thumping Democrat. He really has always had that ability to sort of appeal to the right side of the aisle, or at least some some of the more moderate conservatives in this state. It just didn't play out that way here in Mississippi. This is still a ruby red state in every sense of the word.
38%, or about 40% of Mississippi's population, is Black, and I'm wondering if either candidate made any effort to reach out to that community in advance of this election.
So immediately, as soon as the race was called yesterday for Tate Reeves, there were a lot of people in the state who immediately just started blasting, criticizing Jim Hood for his strategy and his lack of strategy in appealing to that African-American base in the Democratic Party here in the state. I guess it was about Monday, so the day before the election, there were some robocalls that were going around the state. Former President Barack Obama recorded some robocalls on behalf of Jim Hood. The Republican Party used that against him. You know, I think all cycle long, all year long, the Republicans tried to paint Jim Hood as a guy who would be in lockstep with national liberals like Obama or like Hillary Clinton or even Bernie Sanders and AOC. I mean, they really hurled those pairings at Jim Hood, and all year long he really resisted that. And like I said, Jim Hood has received a lot of criticism initially for focusing too much perhaps on swaying white moderate voters and not enough of locking down the base of the party.
Adam, lots of attention is being focused just across the country and in different states on things like voter ID laws, voter suppression, voter turnout. And one of the things that's unique to Mississippi is that there is a Jim Crow era law which adds a hurdle to winning statewide office beyond winning the popular vote. And that's come under scrutiny in the run-up to this election. What was that law and where does it stand today? I mean, it's being challenged in court as far as we understand.
In 1890, which is when our current state constitution was drafted and passed, the framers of that constitution, who were white, they wanted to make it as difficult as possible for African Americans to hold public office in Mississippi. In Mississippi, as part of that constitution, statewide candidates must do two things. We're the only state that does this. You not only have to win a majority of the popular vote, so that's 50% plus one, but you also have to win a majority of the state house districts. Like you said, it has been challenged in federal court earlier this year, and the federal district judge, he refused to toss out those provisions so close before the election. You're right, this governor's race really did sort of put that at the forefront. As it turned out, Tate Reeves, the Republican, did, it looks like, meet both of those provisions. The federal lawsuit is perhaps still in play, but just because of the outcome of the election, I believe, you know, at least for this governor's race, I'm not sure anything will change, regardless of what happens in that federal lawsuit.
Adam Gannis Show is a political reporter for Mississippi Today. Adam, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.